Hello everyone, welcome to JTalk Extra Time. I'm John Steele and I'm joined for our first episode of our J3 season review for 2021 by Mike Innes. Mike, how are you doing?
Hi John, it's good to talk again. I'm absolutely fine, thank you very much, and I think we've made it.
Yes, I know you're referring to the end of the J3 season, Mike, which was a marathon for both of us, but you could also be talking about my intro to this pod, because I think this is my fourth take, but we finally made it. Yes, the season for 2021 is in the books. Also, the first season for JTalk Short Corner, the segment which you run on the pod. It debuted this year, and on behalf of myself and all the listeners, thanks for your hard work each week. It was fantastic listening from start to finish. Without further ado, Mike, we're going to get into our J3 season review. 15 teams in the league in 2021, so we're going to run through them in batches of five. It seems like the easiest way to do it. So in this episode, part one, we're going to talk about last season's top five teams. Before we do that, though, last year when we did something similar, you had some pretty hard-hitting opening remarks for us before we get into teams individually. So take it away, Mike. Could you give us your kind of State of the Union address for J3 from 2021?
Yeah, sure. I'll do my best. I'm sort of thinking back to perhaps slightly painfully, John. I'll think back to some of the preview stuff that we talked about back in February, and how we expected that the season might kind of turn out. And I think it's interesting to draw comparisons and to see where we were right, and you know, even on occasions where we might have been wrong. Before the start of the season, I expected that what we were going to see was a compression in the range of how teams would perform, because at the end of 2020, we had lost clearly the best team in the division in Akita, and by withdrawal, two of the teams who were traditionally some of the weakest in J3, Cerezo and Gamba under 23. That compression hasn't occurred to any great extent in 2021. There were really only at the most four teams competing for promotion, a good few games before the end of the season. And in terms of points tallies, there's really only one outlier in poor old Senaki, who finished 6 points behind the team above them. What we have seen in comparison with last season, though, is all of the teams who finished immediately behind Akita and Sagamihara in 2020. And so in the absence of any relegated teams coming down from J2, you could make a case for them being best placed to challenge for promotion this year. But all of those teams achieved poorer results this year than last. So Nagano finished third last year, dropped down to ninth. Kagoshima finished fourth and dropped to seventh. Tottori finished fifth and dropped down all the way to 12th. Gifu have remained sixth, but if you look at the numbers, there has been a bit of a decline in performance. And then Imabari were seventh last year and 11th this year. And as you run down the 2020 table, the first team that you get to who actually improved this year are Kumamoto, who jumped, of course, from eighth to first. And conversely, all the teams who finished top five this year were mid-table or lower in 2020. You know, Iwate were in 11th, Miyazaki were in the JFL, Toyama were 9th, Fukushima were 13th. I know that our very good friend Stuart Smith tweeted the other day that he felt that the overall standard of the division has been poorer in 2021 than it was last year. Personally, I always find that sort of comparison between one division in one circumstance and another division in another really tough to make. You know, it's like, is J3 better than this division in that country? I don't know. But given that I've described more or less a swapping over of positions between teams who performed well in 2020 and teams who performed well this year, it's reasonable to ask why that might have occurred. My very tentative, very non-scientific reply would be, I think that teams that did well in 2020 have declined more than the teams who've moved up the table to replace them have improved. So to make that a bit more real, and as I say, please don't ask me to justify this opinion, I think, for example, Tottenham have become a weaker side more than, I don't know, Fukushima have improved. I think that is probably true. And so thinking back to what we said pre-season, which was that we felt there was a really big gap between the bottom half and the top half of the division, the fact that that has turned out not to be the case is really the story of the J3 2021 season.
Yeah, no, don't worry. I'm not going to ask you to produce any empirical evidence, because you might turn the tables and ask me for some later, and that will leave me with egg on my face. So no, I won't be doing that. I think you're probably right, though, Mike. Sometimes when teams finish higher up the table, it tells us a little bit more about the bottom half, doesn't it, or how teams that did well in the previous year have declined. But I don't know. It was kind of a weird division in a way this season. I felt like, you know, only having 15 teams felt strange. And then obviously that meant, you know, every week one team didn't play, one team had a bye. So that perhaps skewed things a little bit when I was looking at the table sometimes. You know, there's always one team that had played one fewer game, for example. But I think one thing we can agree on is quality notwithstanding, it was pretty exciting stuff for the most part. I think there's some really good games, and even Fukushima's pitch was improved from last season. So that's definitely in the positive column as well for me. But yeah, let's run down a few teams in detail then, to get some more granular comments. So we'll talk about the top five teams from the table in this pod. So we've already talked about Kumamoto. They finished eighth in 2020, but they're the champions this year, so well done to them. They'll be back in J2 next season after spending 3 years in J3, and their promotion campaign was really propelled by that run of seven straight wins when they came back from the sort of Olympic summer break. Pretty impressive run of form for them. Mike, even with Yuya Sato in goal, they've ended up being champions, and he was fantastic, I have to say, although I'm not his biggest fan, but he was brilliant throughout. What did you make of Kumamoto? How did they get it so right, do you think?
Yeah, how did they get it so right? Well, I think, there is hopefully a pretty kind of solid answer to that question. I was pretty doubtful about them pre-season because they'd lost three really important players from the 2020 team. So the left back, Ishikawa, he ended up at Yamaguchi. Then, of course, as Jay Talk Extra Time listeners will I think probably know, Kaito Taniguchi went to Niigata and Hikaru Nakahara went to Yamagata. And most of the players who came in were university students, so it was difficult to be confident about how rookies would fit into the team. And so I didn't expect that a team which, as we've already mentioned, finished eighth in 2020 could compete for promotion in 2021. But what the coach, Orki, is clearly very good at is exactly that sort of integration of new players and young players. And so we've had a situation where there've been a couple of the rookies have played regularly. That's Wataru Iwashita on the left-hand side of midfield, and Naohiro Sugiyama, who has been more or less a direct sort of replacement for Nakahara and a potential contender for a Rookie of the Year. And there have been important contributions as well from Castro Tardes, who's come into the team more in the second half of the season, and Sota Higashide, although he was injured in August and didn't appear again after that. But also, a really interesting thing about Kumamoto is the way that Orki works with players who are in their second seasons. So the four players that I've already mentioned, you know, they've they played significant roles in the team, but he's really creating a new team around second year pros. So we've got the centre back Sugata, centre midfield Kawahara, who's the captain, and he's basically running the team, and he's 23 years old. The left midfielder Yuhi Takemoto, who came into the team in the second half of the season, was absolutely outstanding. Takahashi is the striker. He was injured at the start of the year, but he was top scorer with 8. So I think that is, you know, that if there's one answer to your question, John, it's that Orki knows how to make a team out of young players. He understands that sort of integration. And to shift, and also what he did was in 2020, Kumamoto were a team that was based on successful attack. They scored a lot of goals. They conceded a lot of goals. This year, they've had easily the best defence in the division. It's a different sort of a team. As you've rightly said, Yuya Sato has had a really good season, not error-free, but much more of a plus than a minus. The defence has been solid, consistent throughout the year, with Sugata, Sakai, and also Kurogi, very, very impressive, on the right of a back three. They had a bit of a slow start, but they were not an easy team to beat. And I think that you could see them gaining confidence in what it was that they were doing, gaining confidence in their ability to sort of scrap out wins in some of these early games, like they went to Fukushima in round 5, Gifu in round 6, and, you know, they're getting late goals to win those games. Not beautiful. Are they blowing teams away? No. But at the halfway stage, that meant that they were fourth. And then, as you've said, immediately after the summer break, 7 straight wins. And that's really how they won promotion. They went to the top of the table. They certainly did have a wobble a bit at the end of the season, but the defence kept that from being too serious. And, you know, you can't argue they go up as deserved champions, I think.
Yeah, I think that's all fair, and I wouldn't argue. I think they only Miyazaki, who we'll talk about in a moment, won more matches than Kumamoto. Right, they had 15 wins from the 28 games, only 4 defeats. That's the fewest defeats in the division. If you've won the second most games and lost the least, you tend to be near the top. And yeah, they're deserved champions. I don't think anyone could argue. I think Toshiki Takahashi is a good shout. There, as you mentioned in your analysis, I think when he came back from injury, maybe in the second half of the season, or I'm not sure exactly when that was, but he made a big difference, I think, calming them with some nerves and some important goals. So, but yeah, I think, like you said, they didn't necessarily blow teams away. They're very much a kind of hard-working side, I think. I don't think they had too many standout stars, but yeah, they were definitely the best team. They deserved to go up as the champions. And I think, the only things that it got me thinking about was it's definitely sort of right place, right time kind of feeling for one or two players and the manager. You know, Takeshi Oki, it's a little bit of vindication for him after obviously things didn't go very well at Gifu, when he was manager there. So it makes you wonder what was the different circumstances at Kumamoto that means he's been successful there, whereas he wasn't at Gifu. And I think Yuya Sato, again, the goalkeeper, I mean, Jeff Calamitous seems like not strong enough to describe the performances that he put in on a pretty regular basis there. So could it be as simple as recognizing that you have a goalkeeper who likes to come out and, in inverted commas, play sweeper, and then to sort of almost combat that, you have a very deep 3-man defence? You know, the defence at Kumamoto is often a lot deeper than Jeff's was, for example, when Sato was goalkeeper there. So I wonder if it's just little things like that that can make the difference, you know, between being a successful team and a successful manager or not. But yeah, we have to say fair play. They've been the best team and they're the champions. And I'm really looking forward to see how some of Oki's, shall we say, unorthodox formations go over in J2 next year. You'd quite often see the kind of pre-match graphic and it'll be like 3-3-6-1 or, you know, 3-1-5-1, I think was for the last game of the season. That's the graphic that DAZN showed. I mean, between you and me, I think it was probably more like a 4-3-3, but even little things like that make it interesting. So yeah, I'm looking forward to seeing them in J2 next year. And like you said, with no complaints, they're the champions and it's deserved. Another team who've had a pretty stellar 2021, Mike, Gruja Iwate Morioka. Last season, they finished 11th. This season, they're second. They're the runners-up. They've earned promotion to J2 just on goal difference from third place Miyazaki. Right? I think a difference of 2 goals means that they finish second and go up. I think I'm right in saying that we sort of softly bigged up Iwate in our pre-season preview by saying they will probably improve from last year. I don't think we went as far as saying they'd go from 11th to 2nd and get promoted, but goodness me, they did. What about Iwate, Mike? What have they done that's so different from last year to end up being promoted with Kumamoto?
Yeah, I'd really like to make that claim that we said that at the start of the season, but we didn't. But in fairness, yeah, we did make the observation that if anybody was going to make the breakthrough from amongst the smaller teams in the bottom half of the division, it was likely to be Iwate. And the reason for that was because in the second half of 2020 under Yutaka Akita, Iwate were really showing signs of improvement, and he was able to continue that into the new season. And they started with a bang, 14 points from the first 6 games. They did have little groups of sort of poorer results, but they were always able to kind of pull out of them. So, for example, they had not great performances and losses to Gifu and Fukushima in consecutive games in May. And then they beat Fujieda 4-0 and knocked Sendai out of the Emperor's Cup. They were sixth at the halfway stage, but the second half of the season was really incredible. 31 points from the 14 games, one defeat. They were maybe slightly less capable of delivering consistently compared with Kumamoto, but they were very consistent in terms of the way that they played. They always used a 3-4-2-1. Somewhat in his own image, Akita had a trio of big players in the defence, experienced captain Yusuke Muta, incoming Masahito Onoda from Yamagata. I know that he's generally reckoned to have been one of the players of the season. And they had a 21-year-old Shogo Sasaki on loan from Kashima, who was introduced in the second half of the season when Wakimoto switched to central midfield. Let's pause to observe that this trait of introducing players in the second half of the season and to them being impactful, that's quite a characteristic of a number of the teams that we'll be talking about today. At Iwate, during that second half of the season, we saw several young players blossom. They might have been in the team earlier on, but they really seemed to develop second half of the season. Brenner is the most, perhaps the most sort of like visible example. He's really maturing now into a good all-round team player. He's skillful. He's not just a physical presence. He leads the line, but he's very unselfish and he's always looking to bring teammates into play. I think he's starting to look like a really good player. There's Yuki Shikama, again, maturing in one of the two sort of attacking midfield roles behind Brenner. And two players that Akita would use as impact subs. There's the rookie Paul Bismarck Tabinas, notionally a centre-back, but deployed mostly as an aggressive kind of right midfielder. Whenever I seemed to notice him, he was always charging up the right wing, you know, terrifying some poor sap of a left-back. Megumu Nishida, a skillful little player in his second pro season. He's on loan from Kanazawa and has been used as an attacking midfield player. And together they helped Iwate to put the opposition under pressure more as games went on. They were a team who would almost get stronger or more dangerous as the games went on. And that's without mentioning Taisuke Nakamura as a left midfielder. He's 32 now, very experienced, one of the classiest players in J3, pretty unrivaled with his set plays. There's a strange question, isn't there, John? We were talking in the green room beforehand a strange question about why Akita chose to bring in the teenage goalkeeper, Taishi Brandon Nozawa, on loan from FC Tokyo for the second half of the season, with the dependable Kohei Doi dropping to the bench. Nozawa certainly made some decent saves, but he also made some significant errors. I was taking a look back at some of the highlights, including his debut against Hachinohe, when he came out for a ball that he had absolutely no chance of getting, and Hachinohe scored. And earlier on, he'd conceded within 90 seconds of the start of his first ever pro match. But the proof of the pudding is in the eating, and Taishi Brandon Nozawa is, in his debut season, a promotion-winning goalkeeper.
Yeah, I think the fact that the mentioning these kind of summer signings that came in and made a big difference is important. I'm not sure if I missed. Did we mention Masashi Wada coming in?
I didn't mention Masashi Wada, but no, he's almost an archetype. He really did add a lot to the team. It took him a little bit of time to kind of like get involved, to find his place. But he chipped in with some very important goals, and he was a really, really bright spark. Again, typically in those sort of attacking midfield roles. No, he really did play well, yeah.
Yeah, I think for Iwate, they just seem to hit upon a formation and a core group of players that worked really well, and they stuck with it. But I think you're totally right. We've got to give Yutaka Akita some credit, because when there was a chance to bring in fresh players like Brandon Nozawa in goal or Wada up front, for example, he did that, and he wasn't afraid to kind of chop and change the team even though it was winning. I think, as we mentioned, they finished 11th in the table last year, and in the first half of this season they had a pretty reasonable first half, 6 wins and 4 draws, so you could sort of almost see them kind of being happy with that and accepting it as being like moderate improvement from the previous year. But they really went for it after the summer break, didn't they? They reeled off 9 wins in the second half of the season, 4 draws, just the 1 defeat. I suppose we can say we can probably attribute some of that to Brandon Nozawa in goal and Wada up front, coming in and just freshening things up for everybody. So, yeah, and I echo your comments on Brenner. I think he has impressed me with his unselfish play. He shoots when it's right to shoot, but he also plays in other teammates, and he always has, the system is he's the lone striker, but there's the two shadow players behind him. He's always looking to play them in or link with them if he can. And yeah, Taisuke Nakamura, kind of always been a J2 player for me, still scratching my head to work out what he was doing in J3 in the first place. But I'm not sure, I'm on record as saying that I really like Shou Hanai at Toyama, who we'll talk about later. But I think Taisuke Nakamura's dead ball delivery this season, I don't think there's a better player, taking the corners and the free kicks in J3. Maybe Tokach at Fukushima would disagree with me on that, but I thought his dead ball delivery was brilliant all year. And I think Iwate are kind of a good demonstration of what you can do, even if you have quite limited resources. If you're well organised and hard working, and everybody in the team knows their roles and is well drilled, it can take you pretty far in the J League, certainly in J2 and J3, and that's kind of the situation Iwate found themselves. So absolutely fantastic for them to get promoted, and I'm really looking forward to see what they do next year, because only 2 teams will go down from J2 last year. Iwate at the moment look to me like they'll have a hard time, but they might be okay finishing. I'm not sure they'll go into J2 and be one of the 2 worst teams straight away, based on what I've seen this year. So, yeah, well done to them. And it's going to be fantastic to see another team taking their first steps in J2 next year. Brilliant stuff from them. Speaking of brilliant stuff, Mike, Tegebajaro Miyazaki, it was their debut season in J3. I'm pretty sure that when we did our pre-season preview, we were pretty light on detail about what their starting lineup and tactics would look like. And I think that continued for me for the first month or two of the season. What we can say is they're pretty good, aren't they? They were a pretty good side. They ended up finishing 3rd in the table on 53 points, the same as promoted Iwate, but just behind them, 2 goals behind on goal difference, meaning that they were ranked lower. I think the only player in the squad that I was aware of was probably Shoma Mizunaga before the season started. I think you picked out maybe Fujioka as being a kind of well-known JFL sort of goal machine or highly regarded player. But I knew nothing about Umeda up front and a couple of the other players who caught my eye during the season. So Miyazaki, how stunned were you that they've come into the J3 league and finished third in their maiden season?
Well, it's not that I'm stunned. That's the interesting thing here. I was doing a bit of the old internet research the other day, and I noticed that Naruyuki Naito, he came in as a coach a year ago, and I understand that he did that really because he had the coaching certification that his predecessor Keiji Kuraishi lacked, but Kuraishi stayed on to work alongside Naito. And their own ambitions for the season were clear because they state them on the club website in their profile texts. They had a target to finish seventh. It's as clear as day. So it's very difficult to predict how a team will perform when they move into a higher division, as you've just referred to, really, John, especially when they're doing that for the first time. But very few people, including, it would appear, the senior members of their own coaching staff, would have expected Tegevajaro to achieve the results that they did. And to my mind, in terms of their style, I'd be interested to hear what you have to say about this, John. They were a neat technical team, simple 4-4-2 formation, everyone knowing their job. I wouldn't say they're a fast or an aggressive team. Maybe one for the people who like a bit of style. And the thing that stands out about them is the quality of their attacking play. They scored more goals than any other team in the division, and they tended to do that by incisive, imaginative passing and more than their fair share of superb shooting. They certainly did not rely on set plays. As for the team, it was mostly made up of players who have been either wholly non-league or who previously were kind of like fringe players for other J-League clubs. And maybe there was a sense that those kind of guys were really motivated to prove themselves. So, for example, you've got Shunsuke Ueda, who was pretty assured as the main goalkeeper. He, some seasons ago, played one game for Kagoshima. And neither Kazuki Chibu in central midfield or Kosuke Fujioka, who you've just mentioned, ever broke into the team at Okayama. They were both at Okayama. And Fujioka, arguably J3 Player of the Year this year, scorer of 10 goals. Naito and Kuraishi kept a pretty similar squad to last season. So with Kenji Dai, centre-back, Kaito Umeda, was the JFL Player of the Year last year. He was the main striker in the team. Both had really fantastic seasons. And two younger players came into the squad and got playing time. Ryosuke Maeda, 21 years old, and another second-year pro. He joined from Fukushima and was a regular alongside Chibu, centre midfielder. And a big rookie forward, Keigo Hashimoto, a third-choice striker who gave them something a bit physical that otherwise wasn't really very present in the squad. I suppose a little bit like Kumamoto, Miyazaki didn't really kind of give teams a beating, but they didn't lose their nerve if they felt under pressure or if they went two or three games without a win. It felt like they were pretty confident that their kind of pass and move and their finishing could help them to get back on track. I think that against higher caliber opposition, I sensed that they would struggle to cope with a higher tempo and with a more aggressive play. But, you know, all in all, a very, very impressive debut season. And I think that their performances have really been one of the highlights of J3 this year for me.
No, I totally agree. I think they're a bit of a funny team to analyse because they are, like you said, it's basically the formation was a no-nonsense 4-4-2. I'm not sure that ever changed, you know, from round one to round 30. Perhaps they switch once or twice, but every time I watched them, it was a pretty standard 4-4-2. And not a great deal really happened with the team until they got into the sort of final third, the attacking third. And then Fujioka, as you mentioned, was just electric. And Umeda, so much confidence, so much ability. It's going to be very interesting to see when J3 kicks off next year, if those two are still there. I think there must be a question mark with them because they've been so eye-catching and so impressive this season. But I enjoyed watching them play, and it was very difficult to see their weaknesses, I think, especially if you watch a lot of the highlights, because you're obviously seeing them just banging in a lot of goals if you watch the highlights. But I think you might be right. I think they're a little bit sluggish, a little bit slow. But, you know, they're only two goals on goal difference away from finishing in the automatic promotion places. They wouldn't have been eligible for promotion because they don't hold the J2 license just yet. But, I mean, in terms of a debut season in J3, I don't think it could have gone much better for them. And I'm looking forward again to see what business they do during the winter, during the off season. And the second season's often a difficult one, isn't it? As Ema Barry found out this year. We'll talk about them in a later pod. But fantastic first season. I think they can enjoy a hard earned winter break, and then come back and do it all again next year. But fantastic first season in J3 for Miyazaki. I think we'll move on, Mike. We'll talk about a team who this is the first team on our list that kind of had a disappointing 2021 campaign, I suppose. It's Katare Toyama, who finished fourth in the table. Still an improvement from last year when they finished ninth, but they actually collected fewer points this season compared to 2020. Yeah, I think for a while it looked as though they were going to be a serious promotion contender, but ultimately fell away. So to frame this analysis, Mike, I'll throw you a question that came in from Gabriele Agnello on Twitter. Nobuhiro Ishizaki, the coach, he's a beloved figure in the J-League, but is it too hard to say that Toyama bottled their promotion chance this season? He says, and he's right, they were in the driving seat for a J2 return for a while, and then had a terrible run and ended up finishing fourth. So Toyama in 2021, Mike, is it glass half full or half empty?
Well, I think that what is clear is that they set themselves up for promotion. That they were really going for it this year, as I see it. I think, like Kumamoto, they lost some important attacking players over the winter. So we had Ohtani, who went to Kanazawa, Hiramatsu, who went to Sagamihara, Take went to Akita. But after they finished a pretty disappointing ninth last year, they got a plan and they did their best to execute it. As Gab says, very experienced, well-respected guy comes in, like Ishizaki. He comes from Fujieda. He brings with him three players, Ando on the left of midfield, Himeno in the centre, and Tsubasa Yoshihira, who I can remember that we spoke about pre-season as a very kind of promising young forward, as well as a bunch of other players like the veteran goalkeeper Nishibe, experienced centre-back Kurogi from Kyoto, and someone that I know that you rated at YSCC, John, the winger Otoizumi. In other words, you know, the club supported Ishizaki in his ambitions for the season. And the first half of the year, it worked out really well. Toyama, as an overall kind of a unit, had a strength and a speed and, dare I say it, intensity that they were able to show pretty consistently. And I think that J3 teams typically find it hard to cope with that sort of pressure. Starting at the back, Nishibe, as the new goalkeeper, was made captain. He's seen and done most things in the Japanese domestic game. Guys like Issei Tone and Makoto Rindo gave them a strong three at the back. Rindo especially, he's not the biggest guy in the world, but he's also a danger at attacking set pieces. But where Ishizaki met with particular success was in his rotation of the attacking players. And every week he'd pick two from three forwards, Ono, Takahashi, Yoshihira, and he picked two from three in the attacking midfield roles. Hanai, that you mentioned, Sheena, perhaps my favourite, and Sasaki. Throwing Ando on the left and Otoizumi on the right, and that was an approach that took Katane to the top of the table at the halfway stage. Maybe not always beautiful, but effective and difficult to play against. So far, so good. We've already spoken about other teams who met with success, making changes to their lineup in the second half of the season. And on paper, I think that Toyama had the most ambitious approach to the same strategy. They even went to the trouble of bringing into the country a new Brazilian forward in Mateus Leiria, who most recently had been playing in the Albanian league. Not easy to make the life transition, never mind a footballing one, from provincial Albania to Toyama as the Zip capital of the world. But he came straight into the team. And the other three forwards that I mentioned, essentially, they had to kind of like rotate alongside him. And while Kumamoto, Iwate, also Miyazaki, to an extent, found an additional gear in the second half of the season, at Toyama, it was really striking to see Mateus trotting around without seeming to have a clear sense of how he was supposed to fit into the team. The kind of like the dynamism of their attacking unit felt like it was compromised, and it just seemed to unbalance the whole side. They were suddenly on the back foot. Each week they seemed to have a bit less confidence. Players like Sheena and Otoizumi, who'd been outstanding, were ineffective. You know, I suddenly realised as I was doing the kind of the reports on the pod, I suddenly realised that I was saying their names so much less frequently. And Ishizaki, who played such a smart game earlier in the season, he just couldn't turn it around, and so they lost out.
Yeah, I think it's probably a little bit reductive on my part, but I think it's clear to see that it was definitely a season of two halves from Toyama, wasn't it? I mean, they only lost two games in the first half of the season, the first 14 runs. That's the same as Kumamoto and Iwate and Miyazaki both lost four games each in the first half of the season. But if you look at the second half, Iwate only lost once, Kumamoto twice, Toyama six defeats, you know, in the final 14 rounds. So it really tells you that something, I don't know if we can hang Mateus Leiria out to dry all by himself, but I agree with you. I don't think he was integrated into the team quite right or well enough. But yeah, definitely the second half of the season sort of fizzled out quite spectacularly. I mean, they've ended up finishing, is it 7 points? You know, 7 points behind Iwate, or certainly, you know, quite a gap between fourth place Toyama and the top three. So yeah, disappointing campaign. The only things I'd add to what you said is I wonder if you know, people who've been to Toyama in the winter, it might not be that dissimilar from rural Albania in terms of the mountains and the cold. So perhaps Mateus Leo wasn't too homesick, or wasn't too out of you know, fish out of water at that point. And I don't know if you noticed this, Mike, so I'll come back to you quickly for a comment. I thought the pitch at Toyama's home stadium, the kind of Toyama Athletic, looked pretty rough in a lot of games. Now, initially, if you looked at it, it was often suspiciously green. You know, like it looked really nice on TV, but if you actually watch any games, the turf looked very very thin to me. You'd often see big clumps of the turf going flying whenever there was any impact or any challenges. I'm not saying that if they'd had a better playing surface, they would have collected any more points, but I just wonder if I don't think that helped. I noticed the pitch looking rough in quite a few games. Do you think that had any impact, or am I clutching at straws there?
I think you're certainly right to say that the pitch was kind of notably poorer than what was the case elsewhere. You know, so for example, you know, Miyazaki or whatever, so it looks like a bowling green, doesn't it? It's not perhaps Fukushima 2020, but it's it wasn't a thing of beauty. They try to be kind of like a reasonably big but fast and aggressive team. quick interchanges of passing, I don't think that, you know, that's not really what they're sort of set up to do. They're pretty big on their set pieces. I don't know how the standard or the quality of the surface would necessarily affect them all that much. You're right to say that it's not fair to hang Mateus Lairia out to dry. What I would I would say on that score is that bringing him in mid season, that's a difficult thing to do. You're not necessarily setting a guy up for success in that circumstance. He's coming into the country. He's never been there before. He's never played there before. It's a difficult situation. And having decided to do that, you're committed to slotting him into this position and into this role, which has got a pretty successful thing going on. So the day that we record, Sunday, he's actually, Toye may have just announced that he's staying on for next season, which I suppose he was always likely to do. So, you know, we'll get another chance to have a look at him, and maybe he'll sort of settle in more, and we'll see a different side to him, and we'll see him have the opportunity to be integrated into the team in a way that was really denied to him in 2021. So, but it was just the fact that trying to make a change compromised a stable setup and a stable team, and Ishizeki didn't seem ready or able to kind of like step away from that. So Mateus started all of the games apart from I think one in the second half of the season, and it just didn't happen for him.
I wonder if it's the case that maybe Ishizeki started to feel we need something extra for the second half of the season, and that was, you know, given the pandemic, you know, restrictions, financial constraints. I don't know. Maybe he was like, we need to get somebody or something, and that was what they could do, you know, with the limitations they had at the time. And to persist with it when it perhaps wasn't quite working was strange. But he seemed like Mateus Lairia did seem like he was trying, and he was doing his best. So let's hope he's you mentioned he's going to be back again next year, and Toyama will go again, and hopefully he's integrated fully. The pitch is in tip top condition, and they can try again. But I agree with what you said. There's definitely the nucleus of a pretty good J3 team, you know, in there that could potentially go into the promotion places with a little bit of polish. So we'll see what happens next year. But ultimately, yeah, disappointment for Toyama in 2021. I think talking about the state of the pitch at Toyama brings us almost suspiciously neatly onto the fifth place team finishing in J3 this year. Mike, Fukushima United, pretty big improvement for them, you have to say. They finished 13th in 2020, but fifth place this time, we should give a lot of credit to the manager, Yu Tokisaki. I think he's done so well that his head has been reportedly turned by some J2 teams. I know it's been announced that he's leaving Fukushima this winter, and it's also said that he's had at least one offer from a team in J2, so he's perhaps moving on to bigger and better things. But a good season overall for Fukushima, even if we take into account the drama they had with their 3-point deduction for breaking COVID protocols, which was eventually overturned, and that they got the 3 points back. How did the season go for Fukushima overall, do you think, Mike?
On reflection, I don't think that Tokisaki has really had the credit that he deserves in relation to what Fukushima have achieved. Having finished, as you said, John, 13th last year, he's taken them to their best ever final placing. And I think he's managed to do that under pretty challenging circumstances. They have this situation where two of their kind of key young players picked up pretty bad injuries pre-season. So the right back who they had on loan from Shonan, Hayato Fukushima, he didn't play until mid-May. Trokacic didn't play until June, and then 5 days before the opening game, one of their rookies of 2020, Tomoyasu Yoshida, left the club for Yamagata. It's quite a sort of like a, you know, a turbulent time. And before the end of the window, under the transfer window, they were able to bring in Shoma Kamata as a kind of a replacement, but clearly he didn't go through a pre-season with the squad. So pre-season really was not smooth for Tokisaki. And also, as listeners will perhaps recall, Fukushima's top scorer, Ismaila, left for Kyoto at the mid-season break. I mean, of course, all coaches need to deal with these kinds of situations, but this seems, you know, really, really tough for Tokisaki. And at the halfway point of the season, Fukushima were joint top of the table. Their weak point in 2020 had been the leaky defence, and this Tokisaki managed to improve greatly. There were some kind of changes made along the way, less of a sort of a constant selection of three at the back than some of the other coaches that we've talked about. But two really important players here were a very experienced goalkeeper, Kaito Yamamoto, who joined from Kumamoto, and the impressive Kazuki Dohana, a contender for Divisional Rookie of the Year. Amazingly, after the departure of Ismaila, Fukushima went clear at the top of the table. The second half of the season, beginning with a pretty extraordinary 4-0 win at Gifu. Not surprisingly, they weren't able to retain their form, and they did sort of slip down the table, especially after it became known that they weren't going to be able to get themselves a J2 license. But I think that there's an argument which says that a fifth place finish for Fukushima is as impressive an achievement as second for Iwate. Just to mention a few other players, certainly I need to talk about Hiroki Higuchi. In his sixth season with the club, scored 9 goals. Great player in the attacking midfield roles, an unexpectedly good header of the ball. In his truncated season, Tokachi scored 7, most of them seeming to come from sensational pieces of long-range shooting. And those guys have really lit up this team. And just to speak briefly about the players they signed after Ismaila's departure, a bit of a sort of a curiosity. Kota Mori, he moved from Yamaguchi, and he added a bit of quality as a sub. A little bit similar, perhaps, to Masashi Wada at Iwate, that we talked about before. Mori took Ismaila's number 9 shirt, but absolutely was not a replacement or the same sort of player. Perhaps intended as replacements were Gabriel Okechukwu and Simon Chibweze. But Gabriel, loaned from Sapporo, made only 2 appearances as a late sub. And Simon, who signed from a Nigerian club, made 1 start and then hasn't been in the squad again. We'll see what that means next season.
Yeah, I think these are all good points, and I think if you're a Fukushima supporter, you've definitely had the sort of the ride of your life this season, haven't you? The massive improvement to go from 13th to 5th, as we've said. Some pretty exciting football was played along the way. I agree with you on Higuchi. He is a player that wasn't on my radar at all until this season, but he was sort of a real poacher, wasn't he? In the penalty area, in the 6-yard box, scored a lot of goals there. In that way, as you mentioned, Tokachi is definitely box office and a sort of maybe this is a bit unkind, but he reminded me a bit of a, you know, Cristiano in his pomp at Tochigi, you know, sort of banging in ridiculous goals on the regular. Also a really good dead ball taker as well. And yes, I think it's a rule that I have to mention Kaito Yamamoto whenever we talk about Fukushima, but I do just want to mention the last season's number 1, Akira Fantini, was brought back in for the last 2 matches, I think, this campaign, last 2 or 3 games. And if the idea was for him to show that he's a real contender for the number 1 jersey, it didn't go great. I think he dropped a cross onto his own defender, didn't he, for a goal in the last game, for example. So Yeah, I think goalkeeper was definitely one area where they needed to strengthen last winter, and they did that. But yeah, I think as long as they don't have the J2 license, they're always in a kind of a bit of a limbo, aren't they? Where they, if they do have a good season, players that have caught the eye will probably get moved on. Maybe that's what Tokisaki, you know, has come to think as well, and that's why he wants to maybe test himself somewhere different. The only other thing I'll mention is it was a bit weird that for the last couple of months, Fukushima's home games were moved from the Toho Bank Stadium, where, you know, to be fair, the pitch was way better this year than last, I thought, when I saw games being played there. But they spent the last couple of months playing at the J Village Stadium in Fukushima, which is quite nice. It's soccer specific, so the stands are close to the pitch, and I don't think it affected their results particularly negatively. I don't know what the reasons are behind that. I know initially when the fixtures were out, all of their home games were at Toho Bank Stadium pretty much. I don't know, the J Village Stadium wasn't on the list of venues. So something must have happened with the pitch or the facilities. I don't know. I don't have any info on that. But yeah, to be honest, it seems like a nicer stadium. Maybe they should play there every home game. But yeah, we'll see what happens next season. I mean, obviously with the coach changing, it remains to be seen who's gonna come in. And yes, maybe some players that have been impressive, like Tokac, I'm sure will be the subject of transfer speculation over the winter. But yeah, fascinating to see next year if they can go any higher than fifth, and also to see what kind of state the pitch is at whatever stadium they decide to play home games at, for the most part. Yeah, all good stuff, Mike. Yeah, thanks so much. I think that probably brings us to the end of part one of our J3 season review. We cover the teams from first to fifth. Mike, if that wasn't too painful, would you be willing to come back and help me out with the teams from sixth to 15th soon?
Looking forward to it already. Yes, of course.
Fantastic. Any closing comments on our top five before we leave the listeners to it?
No, I think we've given them a pretty good going over those five teams. They've deserved to finish where they finished, but there are, I think it would be safe to say that there are kind of like equally compelling stories about teams who finished lower down the table as well.
Oh yeah, very much so. Yes, well, when it comes to part two and you know, 6th to 10th, there are at least two teams that I'm very surprised to see in that bracket, one positively and one negatively. So I'm looking forward to getting your thoughts on those teams in part two. But yes, Mike, let's leave it there for now. Thanks as always to the listeners for downloading, lending us your ears for an hour or so. And if you support the J Talk podcast on Patreon, of course, we gratefully appreciate that support as well. But yeah, that's all for part one. But stay tuned. Part two and part three of our J3 season review are coming up soon. But that's all for this show. So talk to you soon. Bye for now.